In the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks that brought down the Twin Towers, killed thousands of people, did we as a nation decide to go against the advice of Benjamin Franklin? Have we traded some security in exchange for giving up some of our rights? And if so, how has that played out? Well, that's what we're going to talk about this afternoon in this hour of the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen. Kathleen will be back on Monday. There's a new book titled Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. We have the author of that book with us, Karen Greenberg. Her book explores the decade after the cataclysm of 9/11 and how the U.S. came perilously close to losing the protections of the Bill of Rights. Karen Greenberg, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you write about how the United States, as I just mentioned, came close to losing our Bill of Rights protections after 9/11. There have been other points in American history, haven't there, when national security threats put our Constitution in jeopardy or saw an expansion of power in the executive branch?
Yeah, without a doubt. And I could say almost every time, both the times we hear about, like, the Japanese internment of Japanese Americans or the lack of the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War, but there was tremendous amount of civil liberties lost, for example, during World War One. And so, yes, it seems to repeat each time we're in some kind of conflict, hot or cold war. But in this case, what we have is a situation that, unlike prior conflicts, is not going to end. This is going to be, as the best experts tell us, a managed threat that is going to go on who knows how long. And so there's no such thing as the end of hostilities that will therefore cause a pendulum swing back. So what we're really talking about is how to find the balance in real time in a way that can last into the future without this sense of sometimes we go one way because of circumstances and sometimes we go another way because the circumstances have changed. And that's just not the case anymore.
Well, and there seem to be a lot of places, as you point out in your book, where we could have gone one way or another. And because we chose to go one way, a certain set of circumstances came from that. An example that you cite is the case of John Walker Lind, the first American to be captured in Afghanistan. Because
right.
If he had been tried in open court, we might have had a lot of different things happen than what ultimately transpired. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, so John Walker Lind was the first American captured in the war on terror post 9/11. He was captured on the battlefield of Afghanistan, which was a surprise to the U.S. government. They were in the midst of conceiving of a new way to deal with detainees, both in detention and perhaps in military commissions, but those policies were crafted for non-citizens. John Walker Lind is apprehended. He's been abroad for quite a while. He converted to Islam in his teens in the 1990s, and he's fighting with the Taliban prior to 9/11, has joined them to help them out, and he gets brought into U.S. custody. And what happens to him is that during his interrogation by U.S. personnel, he is essentially tortured. There is a bullet left in his leg until they've interrogated him, and they get him to say a number of things. And that are, we don't know if they would have been admissible in court or not because that hearing never took place. But what my sense of this is, and my argument is, that if John Walker Lind had been tried in open court, number one, we would have known about this torture policy well before it happened. We would have known that the United States government was willing to use brutal techniques against somebody for interrogation purposes that was an American citizen. And I think it would have been a red flag. There would have been a lot of protest, and who knows what might or might not have happened later on in terms of the actual state policy, national policy of enhanced interrogation. But the second thing, and really the more important thing for my argument, is that we needed to rely on the court. We needed to trust our courts. We needed to trust the judicial process to be able to have trials, have them in the open. And instead, they settled this one out. And in case after case of high-profile terrorism defendants, Jose Padilla, Zacharias Moussaoui, some in open court, some settled, like John Walker Lind, without the evidence being brought forward, what you see is a sense where the courts are just struggling to handle these cases, and in many, many instances, the judges just don't want any part of this national security portfolio. And so I see that as one pivotal and very early pivotal point in the war on terror.
Well, let's take ourselves back to those days after the 9/11 attacks, and how shocked we all were by the visuals that we saw from Manhattan and the aftermath of that, and the national mood of the time. There were a number of choices that could have been made in terms of how we responded as a nation to that. The government at the time responded in a certain way, but how do you explain our willingness, not just on the part of the executives in our government and the leaders in Congress and so forth, but the population in general? How do you explain our willingness to launch this war on terror and to maintain it?
Well, those to me are two very separate things. Understanding the launching of it is easier in the sense that 9/11 shocked everybody. You didn't have to be in New York, as I was, I don't think, to just be, what just fell out of the sky onto us and why? A kind of naivete, a kind of innocence that was broken through. And it makes sense to me that the immediate response would be out of bounds of what we might normally have done, you know, with cooler heads. That there was just a sense of, we're going to do whatever we want, and we're going to do it in whatever way we can. And unfortunately, our government was also on the path in that category that the normal citizen might have been in. I mean, governments should be able to take a step back, but I would say it's understandable, and I think it's understandable for some period of time, and you pick the dividing line, 6 months, a year, maybe a little more than that. But the second part of your question, which was, you know, launched and continued to have this kind of war on terror, there was no moment of pause. There was no moment where there were saner, cooler heads in Washington or elsewhere that were able to grab the narrative and to say, okay, we reacted. That's okay. That makes sense. We overreacted in some ways. Now let's really think about how we want to go forward. And if we want to make this 9/11 event something that colors the rest of our history or our narrative going forward. And that moment never came. What I show in the book is that there are a number of periods of time where it almost happened. In 2004, for example, but it didn't quite succeed. There were individuals inside government who figured out what had happened and tried to stop it or to make it a little better or curtail some of the programs, and they succeeded in a little bit, but not essentially. And so, so that's, you know, sort of how I see the launch and continue as two separate things.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our program today. 800-642-1234. We're talking with Karen Greenberg, whose book, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, explores the decade after 9/11 and how we came close to losing our protections under the Bill of Rights. Wondering what you think. Do you think that the government, specifically the executive branch, has expanded its power since the war on terror? And if so, does that worry you? Were lawmakers eager to turn a blind eye to the Constitution and pass the Patriot Act, among other things, in the wake of 9/11? And have our national security agencies learned their lesson and are now collaborating one another to keep the country safe? What do you think? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. Talk at WPR.org. And of course, the Kathleen Dunn Show is on Facebook. You can go there and leave a question or a comment. Going back to our discussion of, okay, so 9/11 happened and we reacted, and then we had some chances to maybe let cooler heads prevail and didn't. How much of that do you think was ideologically driven? I read an article in Foreign Policy magazine yesterday by someone who talked about the fact that we've ignored the school of realism in foreign policy for decades, that we've had neoconservative and liberal worldviews, and those ideologies have shaped everything we've done, including the invasion of Iraq. How much of our reaction to 9/11 was based on ideology?
I think I would probably word the question a little differently, which would be to say, how many ideological trends or threads were trying to find a way into a more powerful position in policy in Washington, both domestically and in foreign policy, that found 9/11 to be their entry point. And they had been being pushed. For example, a number of things that were instituted in the Patriot Act, including aspects of the surveillance program when it came to foreign intelligence surveillance, were proposed before 9/11. There were things that individuals wanted before 9/11. The person who drafted the Patriot Act inside the Justice Department put it together by picking up from dozens of proposals that have been made for reforms in intelligence collection and in law enforcement, and took those old proposals and modeled them so that within days he was able to get a first draft of this Patriot Act, which morphed over time until it was passed. But these were not new proposals, and they reflected a kind of ideological conservatism about the world, but also about the realpolitik of exporting democracy, American exceptionalism, and things in that, you know, category.
But there were real problems within the intelligence community, and of course one of those was the challenge of using the FISA courts to obtain warrants. In this case, our failure to obtain one seemed to lead directly to the success of the 9/11 attack. And you talk about that that in your book. So we did have some real problems that we needed to solve, but do you think, I mean, the problem then was we went too far?
You know, yes, we did have problems we needed to solve. I wouldn't say we went too far, but another problem was we went the wrong way. In other words, what were the problems that we uncovered by 9/11, and did we really understand what those problems were? The issue of Zacharias Moussaoui, who had been training, you know, outside Minneapolis to fly a plane, for whom an FBI agent tried to get a FISA warrant, as you said, and didn't get it, but it never really even got to the stage of a formal request. It was turned back early because there was such a chill factor about FISA warrant requests because of some lying that had gone on in earlier FISA requests and warnings from the FISA court that they better bring, you know, affidavits that were valid to the court. And so there was sort of a chill factor. So that's a timing issue, and that has to do with best practices in law enforcement and not with a complete structural breakdown the way I think it's been portrayed. So, yes, there were things that needed to be fixed. And let me say something. A lot of those things have been fixed about the way the FBI functions, about the ability to share intelligence between the various intelligence agencies and government. So that's the good news.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break. Our phones, as we expected, are full, and we're going to take some of those phone calls when we come back. And we'll have more comments and questions and more discussion with Karen Greenberg, author of Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and you can also find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour on the Ideas Network, we're talking about the decade following 9/11 and how the way we responded to that horrible tragedy, the terror attack on 9/11, caused us to come close to losing protections that we've long held dear, protections built into our Constitution's Bill of Rights. Karen Greenberg has a book out titled Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. And that's the topic of her book. She's with us here today. She's the director of the Center on National Security, a nonpartisan research think tank, and a noted expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Lots of callers want to join us. Let's start in Madison. Randy is with us. Randy, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Well, thank you. This may not be a popular opinion, but I think those NSA guys that monitor our communications are among our greatest American patriots. And if it were up to me, they would all get a huge raise. It was a little attempted humor. I wanted to know how Ms. Greenberg ties in the two wars we started after September 11th with the security state, especially because a lot of us liberals thought we should have gone into Afghanistan, that was a necessary war. Of course, Iraq, that was a different story, but it was also 2 years later. And so I just wonder if the two worked together or if there were two separate processes.
So good question. About the NSA, one thing I wanted to say about the NSA is that, you like this idea of their surveillance policies, but one thing I just want to point out, and this is the reason the Patriot Act sunsetted, I don't believe it would have sunsetted for civil liberties reasons. I believe it sunsetted because numerous reports came out from the government saying that the program just didn't work. And I think one of the biggest problems we made after 9/11, and the book goes into the present day, not just for the first decade, it goes all the way to today. And it's a problem we continue to make, is to think that more is better, that the more information we have, the safer we are. And I would argue that the smarter we are about how to target information and target individuals and sense what's coming down the line, the safer we are, and that more, in a way, deceives us about the quality of what we're getting. Turning to the wars.
I just wanted to follow on that first and then come back to the war question. But, I mean, it's long been a problem, a well-known problem at the CIA, that the problem isn't that they don't have information. The problem is they have too much, and trying to sort through it all to find that one piece that might take them where they need to go is makes needle in a haystack seem like a really simple problem by comparison.
Yeah, and it is a problem. And there's sort of a comparison to that, a counterpart to that, in how we did Guantanamo, which is, just an illustration of it more than anything else, which is that we rounded up 800 people and put them in Guantanamo, and the Bush administration officials who were dedicated to the war on terror took one look at who they'd rounded up and knew that they just rounded up too many people. And so they let George Bush let over 500 people out of Guantanamo on the simple reason that they were just the wrong people. They weren't going to give them any information. They were costing us time, money, effort, resources to maintain. And so take that to the surveillance front, and it can be a vulnerability.
So let's go back to Randy's question about the relationship between the two wars that we began after 9/11 and the security state.
Yeah. So we've always fought or talked about fighting the war on terror in many ways. One is intelligence, one is warfare, and another is law enforcement, and they intersect in many different ways. The invasion of Afghanistan not only made sense, but had a tremendous impact in taking out safe havens, taking out training camps, taking out other things that would have empowered the spread of al-Qaeda or even empowered al-Qaeda. And there were estimates at the time where you could ask leading security and terrorism experts around the world how many, members of al-Qaeda were left, and they would actually give you a number as if it was a limited group. That's how how impactful the invasion of Afghanistan was. And then, as the caller probably knows, because he seemed very educated, the United States pulled out prior to going after Tora Bora. And there is a sense that Bin Laden, perhaps, and others, high-ranking, escaped. And it's always been curious, and there's been a number of books written about it, why the United States diverted its efforts under Donald Rumsfeld to go to Iraq rather than finish what they had started in Afghanistan. And I'd be in the camp that thought this is something we should have finished rather than just pulled back from.
Randy, thanks so much for that call. Dave is with us next in Caledonia. Dave, go ahead.
Good afternoon. War is a profitable business. The terrorist threat is real. But it wasn't that bad. 9/11 was allowed to happen to create this system to milk money from the government. And it's just about profit. There were some, the Bush administration was tied to many big corporations and contractors. There was many articles about it at the time. And we're just continuing down that same road. It's just about making profit for the people in power.
That's more of a comment than a question, but I think that's correct. I mean, if you did an accounting, and a couple of journalists and writers have done it, of the vast fortunes that have been made in this war, it's staggering. You know, my focus isn't on that. My focus is what in the process got lost for those of us who, you know, we're living under one set of rules and are now living under another set of rules that I think people need to pay attention to. But that doesn't necessarily diminish your point in any way.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you've been trying to call us this hour, the lines are now available for you, and we would welcome your comment or question for Karen Greenberg, my guest this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about her book, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. You know, we've kind of touched on a number of elements of the security state. The NSA has come up. We've talked about some of the things, the changes that came as a result of the Patriot Act, which have been largely debated. Describe when you talk about the security state, what are the characteristics that make it that, and what are the most egregious areas that you see? The things that we really, really got wrong domestically after 9/11.
So the characteristics of the security state would be, number one, that it is that the rise of intelligence as an incredibly powerful force in every aspect of government, whether it's the Department of Treasury, the Department of Justice, the DHS, which came about, that the number of real and partial intelligence agencies proliferated after 9/11 because everybody wanted in on the intelligence portfolio. Another piece, and this is related, is the vast spread of classification and secrecy, which was already on the rise, but after 9/11 rose exponentially again. And this was across the board to, you know, pieces of legislation, to authorizations within the Department of Justice for things like enhanced interrogation and torture, or things like surveillance, or even definitions of the enemy initially. So secrecy is another big part of it. Another sign of it is the way in which the institutions of justice, for example, that are supposed to protect us, stopped doing that by saying, look, it's not our job as courts, district courts and circuits court, it's not our job as the lower courts in the land to deal with national security. We're either not going to hear this case, or we're going to find a way to put it on hold, or we're going to say that the people trying to bring the case don't have a right to bring the case, but we're going to defer to the president. He's commander-in-chief. We're at war. This is a national security issue, and it's not for us. And so the degree to which some of the institutions that could have provided some balance to this growing intelligence secrecy apparatus in Washington didn't do that. And so that would be another sign of it, kind of a deferential pose on part of a very vital organization system, and that would be the courts themselves. So those are just some of the leading characteristics. In terms of the biggest, excesses, you said the examples of, what went wrong, they are numerous. But the book deals with a number of things. One is terrorism prosecutions, and I can talk a little bit about that. Another one is targeted killings and, the use of drones for targeted killings. Another is detention. Another is military commissions. And another is interrogation. And so I can give you examples from different ones of them. But
please.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about terrorism prosecutions in this country, and it's something in Minnesota that's going on right now, right? There's a jury out on a terrorism case right now. And one of the things that happened early on in the war on terror, and I referred to this without an example before, is the lack of trust in the courts. And I talked a little bit about John Walker Lind, but, prior to 9/11, there were some incredibly serious crimes committed against Americans around the world that resulted in deaths, that were prosecuted in U.S. court, and that succeeded in trying, convicting, and punishing those who were convicted of carrying out or conspiring to carry out those attacks. After 9/11, there was a sense that the courts really couldn't do this anymore. And the problem with that is that if the United States had come up with another system, like a military commission system that worked, then maybe that would have been fine. But what we did instead was to create a military commission system, first under Bush and then under Obama, which doesn't work. And to this day, the United States has not tried, although it has in custody, the people who have been that have been charged with the crime of 9/11 that are still alive. And, that's a very important psychological, ideological, you name it. It's an important moment for Americans, whether we realize it or not. It will help heal us. It will certainly help give some closure to the families of the victims of 9/11. And yet, we've just let that go on, like it doesn't matter that these people get tried or not. And to this day, they are far away from the start of this trial. So, and some estimates are that it could be years and years before there's any kind of trial that comes to an end and there are sentences given out. So that would be, I think, the biggest example of what I could talk about. But there are others as well, and that has to do, let's say, for example, with the fact that we have somebody running for president who can say, I want to bring back waterboarding, I want to bring back worse. What does that mean exactly? What kind of country are that we want to rely on the information that comes from torture rather than from all of the things we're supposed to know how to do best, how to do intelligence, whether it's signals intelligence or human intelligence, how to assess what's going on in a country, our own or somebody else's, through really smart, incisive, knowledgeable, learned intelligence tools. Instead, we want to set a pattern and a possibility of reverting to something that, again, as a congressional inquiry report of 6,000 pages showed, did not keep us safer. And so there's this conflation of things we did wrong in terms of civil liberties and things we did wrong in terms of security enhancements that really is disturbing when you think about what could be coming down the road.
Well, the discussion about waterboarding and how that's come up on the presidential campaign, is that really about intelligence gathering, or is that about appealing to a segment of the public that just wants to see bad things happen to people they don't particularly like?
Well, it is appealing to those who want to see bad things happen to people they don't particularly like, even whether or not they know the facts about those particular individuals. But it's used and it's expressed as something that will keep us safer, which is a different thing than just acting out. But yes, I think in all of this, there's been a degree of revenge and frustration about not finding a way to settle the crime of 9/11, which is why I come back to the 9/11 trial, which, you know, I just think is incredibly important and so far missed moment.
The President Obama ran when he first ran for a president. One of the points that he made was he was going to close Guantanamo, and yet here we are in 2016. Guantanamo is still there. Congress is definitely not interested in closing Guantanamo, and some of the things that went on during the Bush administration that it had been assumed would not go on in the Obama administration continued. Why was that?
Depends on who you ask. I know that the Obama administration, from Eric Holder, a former attorney general, to many others in the National Security Council, blame politics, and you referred to Congress. They referred to that. I think it's more complicated. I think it's that once you break it, it's very hard to fix it. And Guantanamo has been an intractable problem almost from the very start, when the Bush administration realized that they had moved these people thousands and thousands of miles away and didn't have a plan for what to do with them and didn't even, in fact, know who they were. What the Obama administration has now done is, I know many people disagree with this, I actually believe President Obama really does want to close Guantanamo and is making somewhat Herculean efforts late in his presidency to make this happen. And there are, military commissions aside, there have been a number of people who many thought would be in Guantanamo forever who are being released. There are others who have been cleared for release in the last couple of years, over 30 since November. I mean, this place is going to have, in my estimation, only a couple of dozen individuals in custody by the end of this administration. And when that happens, Congress may very well change its mind, because right now, with 80 prisoners there, it's a cost of an estimated $5 million per year per detainee. Now, if the population does drop to a couple dozen, imagine how much it's going to cost per detainee per year. And there won't be that many. And so at that point, I think Congress's hand will be forced to come up with some kind of solution that's viable other than spending a tremendous amount of money on this effort. So, and there are a number of proposals in Congress now that have to do with ways of rethinking getting more and more of the prisoners out there, especially the ones in front of military commissions.
We're going to take a short break. We have some more callers who want to join us. We've got some emails to get to, and we'll do all of that in just a moment. We're talking with Karen Greenberg, author of Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, and with you, should you choose to join us, at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or via Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about what happened after 9/11 and continues to happen up to this day in the war on terror. My guest is Karen Greenberg. Her book is titled Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. We have callers and emails. Let's take an email first. We have an email from Anthony, who writes, the response to 9/11 could be likened to a kind of national post-traumatic stress. The government of the day reacted instead of responded to the event, a hallmark of the fight or flight response to trauma. I would say that the direction that politics is going, vis-a-vis the nomination of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, is an indirect result of this less-than-stellar response to 9/11. When trauma is unresolved, our tendency is to reenact it. I would say that this unconscious tendency is at the root of Trump's popularity. Karen Greenberg, what do you think of what Anthony had to say there?
I think it's smart. I think the country did undergo some tremendous psychological disturbance or trauma on 9/11, and that that Donald Trump is a reaction to that, because so much was reactive rather than thoughtful in how it came about, and that I'm not sure how when you say, well, what went wrong, it's sort of like everything went wrong because people didn't realize at the time, hey, we are in a dire circumstance and we need to really think about this in ways, not in the way we usually go about making our decisions. We think we need to take a pause before we make some of these decisions. And I think that's a very smart way of looking at it. And I think a psychological overview of all of this would be a welcome essay or study for the country.
Sure. Let's go back to the phones. We'll start in Plymouth. And Wes is with us. Wes, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you. I love the show. Your guest is speaking so many of my thoughts. And I apologize if I'm not very articulate about what I'm going to say. But, going back to the very beginning, I don't think that, and some Democrats are using it against Bush, that it was his fault. I don't believe it was his fault. He inherited a system that was set up for this, for 9/11. Your departments that were supposed to be handling the security for the country didn't talk to each other. An FBI agent that brought to attention these people that were taking airplane driving lessons and yet didn't care about learning how to land. There were signs, and if you remember, during the late Clinton years, they were more concerned with pointing fingers at Clinton and accusing him of wagging the dog when he went after Bin Laden. The whole thing after 9/11, the whole country changed, and all of a sudden we just were reduced to the most basic. Instincts of it. You had Abu Ghraib or Grab. You had Guantanamo Bay. If anybody were to dissent, they were labeled pro-terrorists. And I think the biggest failure in our country in the last decade or two has been the press. The press should have been investigating and calling these people out instead of allowing them to do ridiculous, horrible things to a lot of innocent people. And, the response of the press, the radio, the hate radio, and, it was all about gaining power in the political system and not really keeping us secure. 9/11 was very easy for them to pull off, and it shouldn't have been.
All right, Wes. Thanks for the call. Karen Greenberg, you describe in your book you lay out all of the intelligence failures that took place leading up to 9/11. Wes alluded to them there. What about his point that after 9/11 we seemed to really kind of abandon our values, and anybody who dissented was labeled a terrorist sympathizer?
Yeah, I mean And worse than that, particularly individuals who didn't just criticize the government, but who dabbled in any way with something that resembled terrorism. And sometimes it was a result of an FBI sting, because what happened was, and this is really where we went wrong, was that the FBI had always been a preventive agency in terms of looking out for what might potentially cause harm, destruction, crime. But John Ashcroft decided that he was going to make prevention the be-all and end-all of law enforcement when it came to counter-terrorist measures. And when you're talking about prevention, you're in very dangerous territory, and you have to be very careful about it, because prevention, what's the difference between a thought and an act, which is very much the basis of the criminal justice system, got lost in translation after 9/11. And the statute, the material support statute, was used to to entrap, or I'd say rather to indict a number of individuals who weren't necessarily good players, but hadn't done enough to really deserve the kind of treatment that a higher level terrorist, somebody who had bought weapons, somebody on his own without the FBI, somebody who had been in touch, tried to be in touch with people overseas, somebody who had trained abroad. The distinctions became less and less clear as the criminal justice system went year after year beyond 9/11. And so this is something else we still have to recoup, other than the big principles, you know, like executive detention, executive targeted killing, things like that, you know, warrantless surveillance. There's also the sense that we have to recoup a sense of clarity in the law. So I think that comes directly out of that last statement by your caller.
Well, you identify, in fact, at the center of this story is Assistant Attorney General John Yoo, who had seemed to have an enormous amount of power for someone of his rank. How did he, as you explain, ignore some of the most sacred principles of American democracy and law?
Yeah, good question. You know, John Yoo has been explained by others as coming into office with these ideas about executive power already in hand. And it is true that he had a sense of, he had written a thesis at Harvard where he was an undergraduate, and it was much about presidents in the nuclear age. And he does talk about American exceptionalism and the kinds of decisions that presidents, both Republican and Democrats made in terms of foreign policy. But that is very different, I think, than what he did when he got to the Department of Justice and in collaboration with David Addington at the White House, crafted a kind of rereading of the law and the constitutional issues. And you know, there's a nefarious aspect of this, which, you know, lawyers really have to think about and law schools have to think about, which is, while it's wonderful to use the law to try to argue to the end that you want, you have to also be true to the essence of the law, and it's not always up for grabs. So, for example, John Yoo, who very much believed in executive power, command-in-chief power during wartime, and therefore justified the diminution of other principles and liberties in the war on terror, also left out of his memo about executive power the absolute most cited case about presidential power in the annals of the legal profession, which is Youngstown, Tube, and Steel, in which there is a beautiful delineation of when presidents' powers are at their highest or lowest ebb. So it was a kind way to say it would be irresponsible lawyering, but another way to say it would be just plain political lawyering. And it's really not what you want happening inside the executive, but you certainly don't want it happening inside the Department of Justice. So, and he did, look, these things may have taken place without him, but the legal authorizations for surveillance, torture, detention, enemy combatant status wouldn't have existed without his memos.
Mm-hmm. We're getting to the end of the hour. We've got a lot of people on the phone yet. Let's go to John in Milwaukee next. John, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. There's so many things on YouTube about 9/11 that I recommend people that are want to know more to really keep watching that for years, because it's infinite information. But the latest thing supposedly that just happened, that you probably have read about it in papers, was that the victims, Association of Victims of 9/11, have tried to sue Saudi Arabian government for information that will lead to investigating 9/11, and if the Saudi Arabian parts of the Saudi Arabian government were responsible for it. And Saudi Arabian officials responded that if the United States allowed that to happen, they would sell either all their stock or all their bonds in the U.S. government. That's a threat.
Yeah.
And okay. That's one point. The second one is what happened before 9/11 was that the Cold War ended, and the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about, which he knew totally about, warned about against them, but they wanted a new enemy. And they had PNAC draw up a plan for war against Muslims, war in the Middle East, And that was finished about 19.
John, I want to give our guests a chance to respond, and I've got a bunch of other callers I want to get to. Karen Greenberg?
Quickly, on the Saudis, I believe the United States right now is going through its first rethinking of the relationship with Saudi Arabia since 9/11. It's long overdue. That's why there's so much concern, yes, about the civil case you mentioned, but also about the 28 pages that were redacted from the congressional inquiry into 9/11. It may or may not have anything in it that brings alarms. It may not. But this is something that, you know, 15 of the 19 hijackers had Saudi passports. This is something that we need to, the country needs to know. They need to be able to think about 9/11 in an open and transparent way, and it's been denied to this day, and therefore there's a lot of, you know, second guessing of what may be a reality. And this is a very interesting moment going forward in Saudi-U.S. relations, and probably something to keep in mind as we enter the presidential election season.
Do we ever get out of the presidential election season anymore? I think that was a rhetorical question. Let's go to Richard in Fort Atkinson next. Richard, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Well, thank you. I think we as the American people need more to look in the mirror. Back in the distant beginning, the United States wanted to dislodge the Soviet Union from Afghanistan, and we enlisted the help of Osama bin Laden. And that could be taken as a convenient starting point for the total collapse of American policy in the Middle East, which is also quite imperialist, just as the British were. And now we have placed into our legal system all the tools needed to create a tyranny in the United States. The Patriot Act, the rise of the National Security Agency. What happens when a president comes along who has little respect for what we would like to think our traditions of due process and freedom are?
Nothing good. I mean, I think what you're raising is very important, which is why it's important now, and actually we're late to the game, to start thinking about what we've lost, because there's more to lose. And so in all of the issues that you raised, we really need to pay attention, to stand up for what we need, and to force our institutions to do what they're supposed to do, which is not just defer to the security state at every turn.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to make sure that we brought up the case of Edward Snowden. You see him as a kind of unqualified hero. Talk a little bit about your views on Snowden and his significance.
Yeah, so Snowden, along with the ACLU, come across in the very end of the book as getting some light at the end of the tunnel. And the reason I see Snowden like that is that for years, the ACLU and others had been going into court after court and saying, look, there are violations of the law going on. We're being surveilled. Our clients are being surveilled. Our companies are being surveilled. The private sector in general feels like its freedoms under the Fourth Amendment have been taken away. And time after time after time, the court said, this is classified, therefore you can't possibly know. You can't possibly know if anybody's surveilling you because it's all secret. And so you don't have that access and you can't know, and so we're not going to have this case for a decade. And then Edward Snowden comes along, and the very first thing he says when he finally gets an encrypted chat with the ACLU after he's released his first document, which is an order from the government to Verizon to release the records of all of its customers, the very first thing Snowden says to the ACLU is, do you have standing now? And he didn't mean, did the ACLU as an organization have standing just? He meant, to the American people, can they now stand up to their government and say, you can't do this. You can't read all of our information, our content, our metadata, et cetera. You can't do that. That is not lawful. It's never been lawful since the founding of the country, in which not having a general warrant was one of the principles of the founding fathers. So for me, yes, He's a hero. And that is a very, he empowered everybody here, including what you see going on right now with Apple and Microsoft standing up to the government on these generalized warrants. And so I think it's an extremely important moment that we would never have had. And so that's how I see it, and that's how it fits into my narrative.
Well, and I think that's as good a place as we're going to get to leave it. We could definitely have spent another hour on this. Karen Greenberg, thanks, first of all, for writing this book and for sharing this time with us this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Karen Greenberg is the author of Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Kathleen is back on Monday, and Monday at this hour, she'll be talking with a pediatric neurologist about his gripping memoir, Inside Syria, My Life as a Child, a Student, and an MD in the Era of War. The doctor went to school with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, worked with Bashar's wife, butted heads with the Ba'ath Party bureaucrats, and lost friends to anti-Islamic purges. That's coming up Monday at this time on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley and a cast of thousands, including my good friend Dave Potratz, for making this program possible today. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.